Storybooks are meant to be read. And if it's a good story, then that story will have elements of challenge, perhaps elements of comfort. It'll be exciting, or it may be something that's calming. It may be a sad story, or it may be a happy story. But one thing that all good storybooks have in common is that they are always extremely readable. And that certainly describes the book of Samuel. It is a storybook that was meant to be read. Samuel was not just some, you know, academic textbook that's suitable for a bunch of scholars, but rather it is a storybook for ordinary people. And it tells things and reveals things in ways that are easily understandable and easily connectable in terms of understanding the life and the history in Israel. Now, I understand that some of you may have a little bit of a struggle with the idea of a storybook. One of the definitions of our English word story is that of a fictitious tale. That's not what I'm saying about the book of Samuel. But understand that that's just one definition in the English. That the definition of a story by our English word is a narrative, either true or fictitious. Samuel's is true. In prose or verse, which the books of Samuel will include both, designed to interest, amuse, or instruct the hearer or reader. And that's not just an accurate description of the books of Samuel. It really is a description of large sections of the Old Testament that are recorded to tell us how the people of God lived their lives, how they related to God or failed to relate to God, how they related to one another or failed to do so. And especially how God was active not only in terms of the history of the nation of Israel, but active within the lives of individuals who made up that nation. And that certainly is true of Samuel. That it is a storybook that is intended not just to be read by ancient people of long past centuries, but people in the 21st century as well. And therefore, what we're going to do in 2017 is to read through the books of Samuel, 1st and 2nd Samuel. Last year we read through the Gospels. The year before that, I think it was the book of Jeremiah. And so this year we're going to read through the books of Samuel. There are some sheets out there in the foyer on the table out there with the family report and the bulletin that will kind of get you started as we begin to read through one chapter a week for the year. And there's going to be 3 weeks where we'll have to double up to get all of the chapters in. And so there'll be two chapters. I tried to choose shorter chapters for those double ups. But I hope that you will make the effort to read through the story of Samuel. And I refer to it in the singular because though it appears as two books in our English versions, originally Samuel was a single book. It wasn't divided until somewhere around 250 BC when the Hebrew Bible was translated into the Greek, what we know as the Septuagint, and it appears that they split them because they just better fit on the scrolls that way. The books of Samuel are a divinely inspired storybook. They possess a wide variety of styles and forms. And so as we read through the books of Samuel, we'll find sections of poetry and sections of prophecy. We'll see sections of genealogy and sections where there's government personnel records that are found, or even military honor lists. But the vast majority of the books of Samuel are in the form of a narrative, a story. And it's a fantastic story. Accounts of real people in real situations. Stories of battles, whether the battle is external or whether it is something that is internal. Stories of births. That's how Samuel starts out, the birth of Samuel. Stories of marriages and death. Stories of love and hate, of rivalry and violence, of friendship and loyalty. Stories that center on men, or stories sometimes, as the opening chapters do, that really center on women. sometimes on children or aging people or younger people. Some of the stories take place out in the countryside. Some of them take place in the city. Some of them are stories about kings. But many of them are stories about ordinary people. And these stories do more than just relate accurate accounts of past events. Accuracy certainly is an important element, but if we get bogged down in just the element of accuracy, can we trust this, then we miss the reason why these stories were told and recorded for the people of God centuries later. The Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, "For whatever was written in earlier time was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope." He told the church in Corinth that now these things that he has written in the previous verses happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages have come. And then, familiar to many of us, 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. "All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." And those passages apply to virtually every book of the Old Testament, including Samuel. Again, not just relating accounts, not just providing us with objective statements of fact, but stories, especially in the book of Samuel, stories with a purpose, a divine purpose in mind. If we take the books of Samuel as being the Word of God and take that seriously, and I hope that we do, then we must also take seriously the fact that God has chosen to speak to us and to communicate his revelation to us through stories, stories with purpose. And therefore, in the books of Samuel, we are called by God to enter into the story itself, to wrestle with what's being said, to get into the hearts and the minds of the characters as well as the narrator of the story. And as I have entitled our effort this year, to see God at work, not just in the lives of those who are characters on the pages of Samuel, but to understand that as he worked in their lives, he works in our life as well. That as we read through the chapters, we regularly ask ourselves the questions, why is this story being told in this particular way? Why is this element being emphasized while this aspect over here seems to be underplayed? What relevance does this story have for me? What is it telling me about God? And what is it revealing about myself? Am I this person or am I more like that person? And understand that in Samuel, he's not presenting us with some comprehensive picture. He's not telling us every detail about this historical period in Israel, but rather he has selected particular events and he has presented them in a certain way to convey specific points. On other occasions, there are perhaps significant events that have been omitted altogether. At times, the reason for choosing this particular event is told in a very clear way, and the writer supplies us with some easily grasped conclusions. Other times he's less obvious, and therefore our conclusions are left with maybe and perhaps. Robert Alter, in his writing, said that the biblical writers fashion their personages with a complicated, sometimes alluring, often fiercely insistent individuality, because it is in the stubbornness of human individuality that each man and woman encounters God or ignores him, responds to God or resists him. And so when we get to the end of 2017, and it'll come faster than what most of us want it to come, when we get to the end, hopefully we will have come to know more fully, not just the main characters who make up the book, Samuel, Saul, and David, but others who stand on the stage of the books as well. People like Hannah and Jonathan and Joab and Michael and Absalom. And to better appreciate how God dealt with them and how he deals in our lives as well. Now, I just, for the few moments that we have this morning, I want us just to sort of get a feel for the books of Samuel themselves and to sort of dig in a little bit deeper with some introductory information. And I want us to begin with setting this in terms of history. The books of Samuel don't transpire in some kind of a historical vacuum. While they certainly tell us what happened to the people of God during the lifetimes of Samuel and Saul and David, we need to understand that the message of Samuel flows out of the days of the judges and even, in a sense, the days of the patriarchs. That the period of time that we're going to be reading through is only about two or three generations. It is going to begin with the birth of Samuel the prophet somewhere around 1105 BC. And when we get to 2 Samuel chapter 24, we are almost to the death of David somewhere in the neighborhood of 970 BC. And yet, even though these two books cover a little over 100 years, about 135 years, understand that this brief period has tremendous significance for the nation of Israel. It will be a time of crisis and a time of celebration, a time of testing and a time of transition, a time of failure and a time of faithfulness, a time of judgment and a time of blessing. Israel, you remember, has come out of the period of extended darkness in which they were slaves in Egypt. And when they began the Exodus, understand that Israel is only mighty in terms of number. That in virtually every other realm, Israel as a nation is weak, and they are largely, as a nation of people, unformed. And it is only by means of God's grace and the labor and the leadership of Moses and the raising up of a new generation that the people of God are prepared to claim the promise that had been made to them centuries earlier to their forefather Abraham, and the promise in particular was in the form of land, the land of Canaan. After the death of Moses, Joshua leads the people in the conquest of Canaan, and eventually the land of Canaan is apportioned to the various tribes. And yet, following the death of Joshua, the nation of Israel quickly begins to lose its offensive resolve. The people of God become far more interested in settling down and enjoying the comforts of Canaan than in getting to work and dispossessing the remainder of the people who previously had called Canaan home. What begins with association eventually becomes resemblance. That is, the more the Jews tolerated the presence of foreign people among them, the more they began to reflect their lives and to reflect their ways, especially when it came to religion and worship. In the book of Judges that Kurt took many of you through this last quarter, we find the result. It's disastrous for the nation of Israel. That their decision to compromise comes at a very high cost politically, socially, and especially spiritually. That the cycle, the common cycle, six times in the book of Judges is that the nation falls into sin. God allows them to be enslaved, and in the midst of their misery, they cry out to God in supplication, and God graciously responds by sending a deliverer, a judge, to free them, and then the cycle begins all over again. During the time of Joshua's leadership, Israel experiences the blessings that were connected to their faithfulness to the covenant that God had made with them. Judges, however, emphasizes the opposite point. Judges demonstrates what it means to feel the covenant's curse when the people of God choose to disobey. That brings us to the last verse here of Judges chapter 21. Notice verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And so as the book of Judges closes, it has a very negative tone to it. But understand that that verse helps to prepare us for a new development in regard to Israel's leadership. Judges in the book functioned primarily as military and judicial leaders. They were effective in times of emergency, but they were limited by geographical boundaries. They were limited by the nature of their office in that it did not pass on to some successor. And it seems that it was that uncertainty, that they didn't know who the next leader was going to be, that helped to fuel the nation of Israel's desire for a different kind of leader. Someone who would be able to unite all of the tribes together, who would form an effective standing army, and who would go out and lead the nation in war and battle against its external aggressors. Now, what I found interesting is that in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, the books of Samuel come immediately after the book of Judges. In other words, in the Tanakh, you go from Judges to 1 Samuel, as opposed to our English versions where you have Judges, Ruth, and 1 Samuel. And what the structure of the Tanakh, the book of Ruth, is actually in the last section of writings, what is known as the writings. It includes the wisdom literature. It includes the post-exilic books of history, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. But what's interesting then in the Tanakh is that you go from that last verse of Judges chapter 21 and verse 25, there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and then go to 1 Samuel chapter 1. And verse 1, and we go from that to this. Now there was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah. He was the son of Jehoram and Elihu and so on and so forth. And so we go from the book of Judges, where we're told that there was no king in Israel, everyone simply was doing what was right in their own eyes, to immediately being introduced to a man and his family who did seek to live righteously before God, even in the difficult environment and the environment of compromise we know as the days of the Judges. The book of Samuel will devote a lot of ink to political affairs and military exploits, but the opening chapter is surprising, isn't it? Because it doesn't begin with rehearsing Israel's national crisis. It doesn't begin with any kind of preliminary discussion or segue from the days of the Judges into the days of Samuel. No, editorial comment as we move from one book to another. Instead, we are immediately told about the anguish of one woman. And yet, her private struggle will have public import. And so from the very beginning of Samuel, God is communicating to us that the nation is going to be changed for good by individuals who seek His will, who will walk in His ways, who will seek to reflect His character. And in 1 and 2 Samuel, we find a record of the attitudes and the actions of those righteous people, but also a record of their flaws and their failures. It's also important historically to understand that during this time, during the days of the Judges and the books of Samuel, that the land of Canaan is to a large extent free from external control. And what I mean by that is that there is no great world power who is looking to dominate the region of Canaan at this time. Egypt had previously controlled many of the independent city-states in Canaan, but at this point, Egypt is involved in other affairs, and thus there is little, if any, direct involvement on the part of Egypt during this time. You add into that the expansion of powers to the north, what we know as the nation of Assyria, the empire of Babylon. Those two nations and empires are still off in the distant future. And so Israel's battles are going to be waged not only internally in themselves, but when it comes to external wars and battles, it's going to be with their nearby neighbors rather than faraway empires. Look at chapter 4. In chapter 4, we find one of the primary enemies, especially in the first book of Samuel, is a group of people whose land bordered the land occupied by the 12 tribes. The most persistent enemy is going to be the Philistines. They will be a constant thorn in Israel's side. It began back in the days of the Judges with the days of Samson, Judges chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16. It will go through the life of Samuel, the life of Saul, and even into the early portion of the reign of David. We find in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel verses 1 and 2, thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer. Tim, by the way, led the song that had the word Ebenezer in it. Did you notice that? While the Philistines camped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. Look at chapter 13. Over in chapter 13, this is a time now where Saul has actually been made king, and God is has capitulated to the people's demands for a king so they could be like everybody else. And we find in chapter 13 and beginning in verse 5, now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots is how the New American Standard translates it, probably an error here in recording. It's probably either 3,000 or 300. 6,000 horsemen, people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Haven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets, in cliffs and cellars and in pits. Look at chapter 17. In chapter 17, we find the very familiar account of David and his battle with Goliath. And again, we see Israel doing battle against the Philistines. In chapter 17 and verse 1, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. And they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. And they camped between Soko and Azekah in Aphis Damim. The Philistines have actually now moved into the territory of Israel. And they will eventually be defeated by David. But prior to the defeat of the Philistines, they are going to be instrumental in God's plan. It is likely the presence and the threat of the Philistines that compels Israel's desire to want a king. It is going to be the Philistines who will actually kill Saul and his sons and thus help to facilitate the change of power from King Saul to King David. Another aspect we need to touch on is that of prophetic history. It's important for us to realize that not only does the books of Samuel flow out of Joshua and Judges, but it flows into what we know as 1 and 2 Kings. In fact, the death of David does not happen in the book of Samuel. It happens in the opening chapters of the book of what we know as 1 Kings. If we were to read the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, done around 250 BC, what we would find is that these four books are entitled the books of kings or the books of reigns, that there would actually be four of them in the Septuagint. And so there is Kings 1 and Kings 2, which we know as 1 and 2 Samuel. And then there is Kings 3 and Kings 4, which you and I know as 1 and 2 Kings. And it would help us to understand that while we refer to all of those books, including Joshua and Judges, Samuel and Kings, we refer to them as books of history. The Tanakh and the Septuagint list them in a group that is known as the former prophets. And it includes, that grouping includes Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Now, we don't think of Samuel in that way. The Jews did. The Jews understood that the compilers and the writers of these books were not just historians who were chronicling events for subsequent generations to read, but that the writer of Samuel and the writer of Judges and Joshua and Kings, that they were prophets who were acting as God's spokesman. And so as we move from the last judge, who is going to be Samuel, to the first king, who is going to be Saul. His reign ends in death and destruction because he's not the kind of king that God is looking for. And then move to the greater king who has a genuine heart for God, and that is, of course, going to be David. But the writer here is not just supplying us with a historical perspective. He's not just communicating events of interest to academicians or historians. These writings possess a clear theological perspective. They are providing us with God's view of the happenings within the nation of Israel during this time in their history. And thus the job of a prophet was not just to foretell something that was off in the future. That's typically how we think of a prophet. But prophets were supposed to evaluate how well the nation of Israel was living up to the covenant with God in the present, and to exhort the people of God to do whatever was necessary so that they could get back on track with God in the future. And so the prophetic histories, of which Samuel would be one, is recorded for us with the objective of communicating spiritual lessons that would be critical for the people of God in every age and in every culture. That what we find in these two books is, in a sense, a divine commentary on human life. Not just life within Israel, but your life and my life. That they are stories that for the purpose of God showing us that He is sovereign, not just over the history of nations, but in the personal lives of human beings. Samuel will remind us time and again that God accomplishes His purposes and He chooses to work through people. Not just social forces, not just cultural forces, not just economic forces, not just military forces, but people. And therefore, the most effective leader is not the guy who looks like a leader, not Saul, who is head and shoulders above every man, who's wealthy, who's great looking. Instead, it's a teenager, a man who is described as being after God's own heart. God chooses to give us that truth, not in the form of some abstract discourse, but in the form of a narrative that points us to the model of a man. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14, God declares this to be true. He says to Saul, 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for Himself a man after His own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as a ruler over His people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Centuries later, in the book of Acts, chapter 13, verse 22, Paul is preaching in Antioch, and he says this: "After he," that is God, "removed him," that is Saul, "he raised up David to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, 'I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will.'" And so the greatest lasting contribution of the period that we know as the books of Samuel is not going to be an institution or a document or a tradition or an idea. It's going to be the example of a person. Truth incarnated in the life of an individual, and that individual is David, the son of Jesse of Bethlehem. A prominent figure in the Old Testament. 40 chapters of the Old Testament dedicated to the life of that one man. Jesus in the Gospels is going to be referred to some 10 to 12 times as being the son of David. And so there's this connection between what we're about to read in Samuel and what we see even in the Gospels. The question of authorship, complicated. Not going to go into it this morning. Don't want to spend a lot of time on it. Jewish tradition says that Samuel is the one who wrote it. The fact that Samuel dies long before David gets to the end of his life or the end of his reign clearly reveals that Samuel could not have wrote this unless he did it from the other side. Couldn't have penned the entire account. But though Samuel may not have written all of it, the naming of it is appropriate because he is going to be a man of God who is critical as the nation of Israel transitions from theocracy to monarchy. Prior to this point in time, God was viewed as Israel's king. God is the one who specifically chose and designated human leaders as judges and did so only as they were needed. Israel, however, was not content with that situation. In chapter 8, in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 4 beginning, we find that the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." That's what the people of Israel want. They want to be like everyone around them. They want their leaders to have this dynastic monarchy of succession, so that here is a king, and when that king dies, we already know who's going to be the next king. It's going to be one of his sons. And when that son dies, we know it's going to be one of his sons. But they also want more than that. They want a human leader who will look to regulate Israel's life according to some agreed upon national policy. And we find much the same thing in our country, don't we? People don't want to be governed by the Word of God. They want to be governed by the Constitution or some other human document. They don't want to follow the law. And Israel didn't either. They wanted someone who would have this organized machinery of state in place, who would have a standing army that was readily equipped to go out and to defend them against aggressive neighbors who would plunder their crops or threaten their place in the land. While the prophetic viewpoint of the books of Samuel is, or of the monarchy, is certainly negative. That is, it is a concession to a sinful demand on the part of the people. What is emphasized in the book of Samuel is the fact that even though there is a king, that king is subject to the prophet, to the one who speaks for God. In Samuel, in Saul's case, it's going to be the prophet Samuel. In David's case, it's going to be the prophets Nathan and Gad. Now, just a quick outline here of the books. The first 12 chapters, we're told about Samuel, his birth. He is going to occupy the position and the honor of being the last judge. He is then going to be followed in chapter 13 with Saul, who will be the first king. But even though he looks on the outside like you would want a king to look, he's not the man on the inside that God's looking for. And so we are introduced to some of the key elements in his initial reign. We're told of David's rise to prominence, especially after his defeat of Goliath in chapter 17, and the subsequent run of David from Saul, Saul wanting to seek his life, to kill him in order to protect his own kingdom, and hopefully pass it on to his one of his sons. And to such an extent that David, toward the end of 1 Samuel, goes and he hides among the enemy, the Philistines. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, going through chapter 20, we find there the reign of David, faithful, but flawed, not perfect. He rises to power only over Judah initially in the first four chapters. And then in chapter 5 and following, we find that he now is accepted as king over all of the nation of Israel. In chapters 11 and 12, we're familiar with his personal crisis with Bathsheba. And then in chapters 13 through 19, we find that like father, like sons, that David's behavior creates issues within his own household and within his own kingdom. And then the book closes with an epilogue in chapters 21 through 24. And it's also interesting that there is a song that begins, that bookends, the song of Hannah in chapter 2, and there will be a song of David much later in the book, chapter 23. Four themes to look for, and then we'll wrap up our study. Four questions. When you read through the books of Samuel, be asking yourself the question, who really rules? There's going to be a very clear political element to these books. Virtually all of the material contained in 1 and 2 Samuel has some link, directly or indirectly, to the question of who really is the ruler of the people of God. Sometimes there's going to be debate, is it a priest or a prophet? Is it a judge or is it a king? But over the overriding element, is it Saul or is it David? But the overriding element, really, is going to be how human leadership oftentimes interfered with the rule of God. A second question. Who is this person really? Now understand that the characters in this book are not there just to help us make sense of specific historical events that happened to transpire. They are instead to be taken seriously as individuals for us to see, have insight into their personality and their potential. And therefore, we need to explore those people more fully. We're told of their hopes and their fears, their successes and their failures, their ambitions and their dreams, their actions and their indecisiveness. But above all, what we are reminded of throughout the books of Samuel is that these are people who are responsible for their own actions and the consequences that come attached to them. A third question, a theme that we find, and that is, how is power to be used? Again, there's going to be this very clear emphasis on the fact that God has the right to rule, his ability to carry out his plans and purposes in spite of the flaws and failures of individuals. He is going to be the one who anoints and appoints. He's going to be the one who rewards and punishes. But the books of Samuel go beyond just that. They explore for us the nature of power and authority. How should power and authority be used? How can it be misused to manipulate people? And even worse, how can it be abused as people exercise power over others? And that certainly is going to be a prominent theme when David is on the run, an innocent man, from the king, who wields incredible power and looks to take the life of God's anointed. And then the final question, what does it mean to be in a relationship with God? Because these books are filled with stories of people who are in a relationship with God, who understand the implications attached to that relationship. But the books are also filled with people who think they have a relationship with God, and yet who ignore or neglect the demands and the requirements that are involved. These are stories. Stories that are not just meant to be read, but stories meant to be preached. And so as we did last year with our readings through the Gospels, on the fourth Sunday morning of each month, we'll take and look at something a little deeper from our readings from that particular month. Or I'll pick out a section from that, and we'll look at it a little bit more deeply. What an incredible tragedy it would be if we saw the books of Samuel simply as some ancient history to be read by people long ago with little, if any, relevance for us today. Because the truth is, they are stories with purpose. That is, Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, that all Scripture is inspired by God, including Samuel. And it is profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man or the woman of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. And Samuel, the books of Samuel, will help us to achieve that.